supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association releases guidelines for how prosecutors across the state handle shootings by police officers. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that the recommendations are intended to make use of force investigations consistent statewide.
The group said no matter the extent of the injury, the suspect who was shot should receive first aid right away. Chester County District Attorney Tom Hogan chaired the group.
The message is that we didn't want to have to shoot this person. The police did not want to have to shoot this person. And we will do everything we can to save this person.
The prosecutors also recommended that police shootings be looked into by an outside agency. And they also advised not releasing the name of an officer who shoots unless that officer is charged with a crime. Reform advocates like Kelvin Anderson say such secrecy could inflame community tensions.
Officers who have the power to shoot and kill and injure folks in serious ways should be identified.
Philadelphia releases officers' names within 3 days unless there's a threat to their safety. Anderson says he was also troubled by the recommendation to only publicly release videos of police officers who are found to be justified in their shootings.
I think that the public will find that a bit disingenuous.
District Attorney Hogan says his group advised prosecutors across Pennsylvania to cover up a body of a suspect who was fatally struck and then remove the body quickly. It's a lesson from the 2014 shooting death of Michael Brown, whose body stayed in the middle of the street in Ferguson, Missouri for hours.
For everyone to take pictures of, for everyone to view.
Hogan says that sends the wrong message.
Our guidelines say if the person is dead at the scene, shield the body, cover the body. I don't care how bad the person was. They have family, they have friends, and you have to show some dignity.
The suggestions from the elected DAs are non-binding, but the hope is that prosecutors will still adopt them. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Despite years of effort, complaints keep coming in about rogue tow truck drivers in Philadelphia. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that City Council is considering bringing police into the mix.
Currently, tow truck drivers only have to take a picture of illegally parked vehicles before they're towed. If the bill before City Council is approved, a police or parking enforcement officer would have to write a ticket first. Then drivers can tow away the car. Semi-retired attorney Robert Price says he took the time to testify in the city council hearing in order to drive home why he believes the tow truck drivers are operating outside regulations. He claims he was towed from what was a driveway leading to a now empty lot.
There is no way to get onto the property. You'd have to go through a chain link fence. And on the other side of the chain link fence now is an abandoned lot, which maybe someday we'll have something built, but there's nothing there that could possibly be a driveway.
Fran Healy, who's special assistant to the police commissioner, says it's a few tow operators who are violating the regulations constantly.
Many of these vehicles are being removed at two locations and pictures are being taken, so they have the required photograph, but there's no indication, nobody else has been there to confirm that these cars were in fact legitimately towed.
Tow operator Lou Blum came to the hearing to argue against the bill.
I represent homeowners, small business owners, and parking lots. If a vehicle is illegally blocking anyone before the vehicle mentioned group, this could cause them lost income or their right to come and go from their property. Our police force should be concerned with about higher priority crimes. Taking our hardworking police officers away to answer these tickets calls it a crime itself.
He says the problem could be addressed by educating tow truck drivers. The bill cleared committee and moves on to the full city council next. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Firefighters and city leaders in Wilmington, Delaware are calling on Fire Chief Anthony Good to keep a local engine in operation, even if that means more overtime. WHYY's Zoe Reed explains.
The practice of taking fire trucks out of service is an unpopular but common strategy to save on overtime costs within fire departments. Wilmington Engine 6 on Union Street will be shut down for the rest of the year because the department has used all of the $500,000 the city allocated for overtime. The department had suspended the practice after firefighters Christopher Leach and Jerry Fickers were killed in the line of duty in September. The engine closest to the burning building had been closed down that day. While no connection to the deaths was proven, firefighters were outraged when Good reinstated the practice a couple weeks ago. City Councilman Bob Williams says the department is down 19 firefighters, 20 firefighters are on desk duty, and there are no plans for an academy class.
The problem is that the chief is not coming forward with a plan to stop this. If he came to us with a plan saying, I'm going to recruit a class, I'm going to get things in line, this is how we're going to do this, I think you could get 7 votes on council to get that passed, to keep these engine companies open. It doesn't make sense. To me, it's just kicking a can down the road, and it's letting the next administration worry about this. And to me, that's just poor management.
Bruce Schweiger of the Firefighters Union says closing engines is a safety risk, delaying time until the first engine arrives. He says it puts a burden on other fire companies.
You're basically relying on an outside source to help us, which they're more than willing to do, and they do it a lot on our bigger events. But at a certain time, they need to go home. Some of them are volunteer firefighters that have full-time jobs where they can't sit in here for 36, 48 hours with us.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
The now-resolved troubles in Northern Ireland refer to a time in history before the birth of many of our listeners. A former Connecticut congressman is credited in large measure with efforts to end decades of enmity between England and Ireland, and this unsung hero is the focus of Peace Runner, a book by Penn Rodine. Penn, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me. Real pleasure.
The subtitle of the book is The True Story of How an Ex-Congressman Helped End the Centuries of War in Ireland. So yes, the Troubles refer to roughly a 30-year period that ended in 1998. Take a moment and tell us about the centuries, after which I'm sure was merely in the DNA of those affected by it.
Right. The British invaded Ireland in 1169. These were these Norman Brits who became Englishmen in 1066 and then went to Ireland in 1169 and were there basically ever since. It waxed and waned to some extent, but there was a lot of fighting. And the Irish didn't much like having the British take over their country.
Analogous, in a sense, to Europeans colonizing America?
I think worse, because it was theirs in a way that, remember, the colonies were 3,000 miles away in times of slow travel and nothing electronic. But Ireland was right there, and it was pretty brutal. And there were horrendous times. Henry VIII really ratcheted it up. Oliver Cromwell was the worst. And then the fantastic British indifference to the starvation in the 1800s is pretty awful.
And with the potato famine, that begat the wave of Irish, or at least one of the waves of Irish, into the United States.
Right. You had a country of 8 million people. About a million died in the Great Hunger.
A million of eight.
A million of eight, and about 2 million emigrated within that period. So it profoundly changed it. But it opened up the connection in the U.S., and that was great for this process, by the way, this peace-building process in the 1990s.
Well, we can thank in large measure for that process a then-lawmaker named Bruce Morrison, who authored legislation allowing for more Irish citizens to come into the United States.
Right. But it should be understood that when he actually got involved in the peace process, as opposed to authoring the 50,000 Morrison visas that gave him great credibility there, he was out of Congress at that point. He had had a horrific electoral defeat, and his career in Connecticut was destroyed.
Let's also touch on a law school colleague of his, one Hillary Clinton.
One Hillary Clinton and one Bill Clinton.
And so when it came time to try to effect change, he already had their ear.
He did. He understood that to change American policy and to make it stick, a president would have to take it on board.
The book lays out the essence of that brilliant strategy. Explain.
Yeah, it was a matter of, first of all, getting a candidate who could be open to the idea that policy needed to change. Our policy was always, we're Britain's friend, it's an internal matter, we buy that. Morrison says that he said to Clinton, 44 million, that's a number that was floating around, how many Irish Americans there were. So you're running for president, start with that, a lot of votes. So you had that one element of pure politics. You had the element of this is a terrible thing happening in the world and it can be changed, and that it really would be historic.
Was there a tipping point for Bruce Morrison when he thought that, yes, this not only can but will happen, will eventuate?
Well, certainly reaching the agreement on Good Friday with George Mitchell's brilliant idea to impose a deadline after long, long negotiations, that was a key part. Ratification by the entire population, a key part. And then the worst bombing was actually after the Good Friday agreement in the summer of 1998. For me, the real story of that event is how did they keep that from wrecking the peace process? And they did. The entire world literally came there. The Pope weighed in. The Queen weighed in. Prince Charles showed up. Clinton showed up. Tony Blair showed up. There was an outpouring of support for the peace process. So even that terrible bombing couldn't stop it. And that certainly was a great sign.
Penn Rodin, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
Penn Rodin, author of the book entitled Peace Runner, the true story of how an ex-congressman helped end centuries of war in Ireland. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. And this note, Penn Rodin will be appearing next month, Wednesday, the 14th, at Newtown Bookshop. And then the following day, Thursday, the 15th of December, at Barnes & Noble on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. For many fans, the Eagles are in an all-too-familiar place right now, as the early season promise of a rookie head coach and a rookie quarterback has been dampened by defeat and injury. Last night's 27-13 loss to the Green Bay Packers could be viewed as the point in the season where hopes and plans turn to next year, as thoughts of the playoffs fade away. Here to take stock of the Birds is Philadelphia Daily News sports writer Marcus Hayes. Marcus, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Why don't we start with Eagles quarterback Carson Wentz, seen as a bright, shining star, back in the summer. Last night, though, really pointed to a mismatch with the Packers' Aaron Rodgers.
It's kind of the way that Allen Iverson was mismatched against Michael Jordan for several years. Aaron Rodgers, in my opinion, is the best there's ever been. He's a transcendent quarterback. He understands the position probably like no one else has ever understood it, who has his physical gifts, both his arm strength, his accuracy, and his ability to escape pressure. And he's also a very interesting and introspective guy, which lends itself to leadership. If the Eagles see Carson Wentz develop into 80% of Aaron Rodgers, there'll probably be a trophy or two in their future.
At this juncture, do most Eagles in the know see him in that regard as somebody with that kind of a potential?
They really do. Carson Wentz is a spectacular talent. He's very raw, but he's an incredibly hard worker. All of that portends well for the Eagles as they go forward. Just before the season began, they traded their starting quarterback, Sam Bradford, to recoup some of the draft picks that it cost them to get Carson Wentz. I think what they found out in the preseason is they were pretty far away from contending even with Sam Bradford. So they said, you know what, let's step back a year or two. Everybody else in town is doing it, the Phillies, the Flyers to a degree, and the Sixers to the nth degree. We should probably do that as well, build through the draft, wait for a good free agency crop, especially at wide receiver, and see what Carson can do.
Is the Eagles coaching staff, led by another rookie, Doug Peterson, up to the task of sculpting this talent?
It's interesting, their quarterback coach situation, especially at offensive coordinator where they have Frank Reich, and of course Doug Peterson, who was, like Frank Reich, a backup quarterback for his entire career, essentially. You have two guys who sort of maxed out mentally as far as being a quarterback in the NFL, so there won't be anything Carson Wentz won't be privy to learning. However, these are two guys who didn't play a lot, so when Carson Wentz has a few bumps along the road, they might not be the best counselors for him. But generally, that's the sort of thing an athlete has to grow through himself.
Lead us next through what remains in the season for the Birds. Any chance they can sneak into the playoffs?
I can't see it happening. They played atrociously in their division, and all but one of the next five games they'll have a real hard time winning because they've got some pretty serious injury issues, especially on offense.
Talk about who's injured for the Eagles, and if they lose again in the next week or two or three, would it be wiser to just let those players sit for the balance of the season?
I am a huge proponent of cutting your losses, especially with young guys. We've seen it happen the last couple of years with the Sixers, where they were very, very cautious. But Jordan Matthews, their best wide receiver in his third year, has an ankle issue right now. Halabaputi Vaitai, their young rookie right tackle, who could be a huge, huge player for them in the future, has a knee issue. I know that Jordan Matthews is probably going to play this coming weekend on Sunday at Cincinnati, but if they lose that game and things start to get out of reach, I don't see the benefit of him maybe exacerbating that injury. And honestly, there's a guy named Lane Johnson. He's serving a 10-game suspension. He has three more games to go. I don't know how they're really served letting him play when he comes back. It's been interesting to watch Doug Peterson, the rookie coach, deal with the sorts of things they've had to deal with. One of their linebackers, Nigel Bradham, allegedly beat up a Cabana boy, then was caught with a gun in an airport. Josh Huff, who's been cut, was stopped for DUI with a gun and hollow-tip bullets. Sam Bradford walked out of off-season workouts. I mean, it's just been a kind of a mess, kind of a jailbreak. It's really been kind of an unprecedented season for a rookie coach, and generally he's handled it extremely well. I think he's going to be a real good coach. He makes some mistakes on the field, but I think he's going to be a really good coach in a year or two.
Marcus, thanks so much for filling us in.
Dave, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Philadelphia Daily News sports writer Marcus Hayes. And now an alternative to turkey leftovers. Muskrat. WHYY's Mark Eichmann digs into this delicacy that's delighted diners along the marshes of the Delaware Bay for centuries.
It's a rarity to find a restaurant still serving muskrat in Delaware. The small rodent that once helped keep bellies full during hard times has all but disappeared from dining room tables. But that's not the case at the Southern Grill of Ellendale.
Folks from all over the place, come and get that rat.
Ronald White owns this Sussex County diner that fills with muskrat fans every Wednesday night during muskrat season from December through March. Longtime Delaware newspaper reporter Robin Brown says people used to eat muskrat like they ate rabbits or squirrels.
Back in the days when you ate what you killed, muskrat sustained a lot of marsh areas, including Port Penn, where they used to have an annual muskrat dinner to celebrate the legacy of the little rodent that kept them going in hard times.
Kept them going and keeps them coming to the Southern Grill even today.
Wednesday night, the phone's ringing. It's ringing all week long. Muskrat, are you having muskrat? People pile in here and have good conversation and good muskrat.
Waitress Claire Parker stays busy serving muskrat fans. Some, like Chuck Coverdale, order their muskrats with the heads on.
That's the best part of it right there. The jaws and the brain. That's the best part. And all you have to do to get the brain out of it. And there it is, right there. Right there. It's a little tiny. It looks like a little almond is what it looks like. That's the brain.
I may not be as brave as Chuck, but I gave it a shot.
All right, so here we have muskrat three ways. We have muskrat plain, we have muskrat in gravy, and we have barbecued muskrat. And I've been told that we should start with the gravy, so that's where we'll start. Just dig right in, or we got to... It's not bad. I'm going in for bite two. It's the bone that gets you, though.
The bones that get you.
Others aren't so eager.
They'll see the plate and say, what is that? Oh, my God. They've never seen a muskrat before.
Todd Chappelle is not a fan.
I can't go there. I really can't. Something you pulled out of a swamp and put it on my plate. I can't.
The obvious question is, what does muskrat taste like?
Of course, it's a little gamey. Okay, it's a little gamey, but, you know, whatever you taste you have in your mind, that's what it's going to taste like.
Muskrat fan Jim Bosco agrees with that non-descriptive description.
Basically, it has a taste of itself. You know, I mean, it's people say, oh, it tastes like chicken or roast beef. No, it has a taste of its own, but it's good.
All right, so here's the barbecued muskrat, which I've been told you get the hind quarters out, and that's where the good meat, the good eating meat is. The barbecue is good.
People call them marsh rabbit. Make it sound a little bit more palatable.
But that renaming doesn't fly with reporter Robin Brown.
There's something I'd like to clear up about the muskrat. You can call it muskrat. You can call it marsh rat. You can call it mush rat. But please don't call it a marsh rabbit. That's a whole nother animal.
Delaware's muskrat trapping season runs December through mid-March, and that's generally how long diners have to enjoy or avoid this Delaware delicacy.
I know that there are a lot of people who love it and swear by it and think it's great, but I'm not a muskrat fan. I don't have that muskrat love. Muskrat
love. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Time to clear the table. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.